This is Everything is Workable, a podcast that examines how every experience, every situation, every moment is totally workable with the right tools and understanding. I'm your host, Caitlin Hatch, creative polymath and dedicated consumer of wisdom. In this season, I'm speaking with other people about their approach to life and practice. This episode is with my wonderful and wise Aunt Juanita. She began drinking in her teens and then sought sobriety when she was 26. At that time, she stayed sober for 6 years. Now, armed with new tools and a stronger recovery plan, she is enjoying sobriety once again, as of January 1st, 2015. In our conversation, she shares with me insights gained from her recovery from alcoholism, from taking personal responsibility to cultivating gratitude by seeing all that there is to appreciate in life. As ever, if you enjoy this episode or any episode of Everything is Workable, you can support it by sharing the link, as well as by visiting caitlinschatch.com and leaving a tip. And now, on to my interview with Juanita. So, on this show, I talk to people about their practice, and usually we speak in really general terms, like about how they approach life, and then they might share a few specific examples. But with you, I do want to get really specific, because what you have to offer is an insight into addiction. And that, for a lot of people, feels really unworkable. I mean, still same opening question. If you could just give a brief summary of your practice and approach to life, or your life philosophy, if you will.
Okay. Well, so my practice and approach to life, it's based on my recovery from alcoholism. That's my practice, I guess. That's what I live every day. I work at my recovery. I work at growing up and maturing, and I don't know what to say.
I guess just like to get into that a bit then. Like what's been your journey exactly to recovery?
Well, for the first year, it was I considered it my physical recovery. Mm-hmm. Although I didn't necessarily believe that I was, and I still don't, that I was physically dependent on alcohol. It still takes a toll on your body, I believe, whether you're physically dependent or not. It still takes a big toll on your body. And I think your body needs time to recover. I think your brain needs time to recover. I think your soul needs time to sort of wake up before you can really start to get into the business of living and discovering what life is and discovering feelings, my feelings, basically maturing and growing up, doing things that, you know, people did when they were teenagers and in their young adulthood. And, you know, in my late 50s, I'm doing that now. You know, all those years of drinking kept everything all tamped down, kept my feelings tamped down. I wasn't really able to view things from an accurate place. Everything was always very distorted for me. So, yeah, so it's sort of like clearing the windshield and seeing life through completely different eyes.
Mm, yeah, and lots of self-care.
Lots of self-care, absolutely. I've abused myself basically for quite a few years. So, you know, it's body, mind, and spirit all coming together and having a chance to grow and open up and experience life now for the feels like for the first time for me.
That's really good. I think with self-care, I think that there's a sense that we talk about it a lot, but we don't necessarily get explicit about it. So for you, like you said you took a year of giving yourself time to physically heal. Mm-hmm. What other elements of self-care? Because like I think that's probably the obvious one that people can go to. They're like, right, self-care, it's about taking care of your body. But it's like, well, actually, yeah there is your mind and your spirit. And how those work together and how all of that works together. So what does that look like? How does it look like for you?
Well, also, you know, the other things I did, I sought out counseling for a while, and I probably will again at some point. I'm just on a break from it for now, just to have somebody to bounce things off of and to help me with my perspective on things. I take care of myself in ways that are just simply pleasurable things, and pleasurable in a healthy way. So I've always loved to read and write, but in the latter years of my drinking, I was not able to write anything. I could write a sentence here, like literally could write a sentence here or there, but I could not put together a paragraph or a page or anything. I was just so completely shut down from anything inside of me. So, I'm getting back into writing again, reading just to, you know, sit down and read a book for an afternoon and just say to heck with everything else, to heck with, you know, housework and to heck with the dishes and who cares if things are dusty. I've got this great book I need to get into and read. Scrapbooking, which is one of my hobbies, and I really enjoy it. So I've really applied myself to that. So just doing things that are just pleasurable to me. Walking is a very therapeutic, healing thing for me. So I do that quite a bit. It's one of the places where I really connect with God is when I walk. It's sort of like I just automatically go into a place where I just have conversations with God and have a lot of epiphanies and really feel my gratitude when I'm out walking. Prayer, absolutely. And I don't mean, you know, prayer, ritualistic type of prayer with, you know, and say A and B will happen and say C and D will happen. It's just like, I'm just like, hey, God, it's me. Yeah. I just, you know, so I have that going on all the time. I kind of have a little bit of a dialogue with God going on pretty much at all times. So when I'm going through my day, and I'm feeling a little, I'm losing my train of thought on this one here. But yeah, I keep an open dialogue with God going. I don't feel like we have to find him in church, that he's only in certain places. I think he comes down to meet us exactly where we are. Mm-hmm. So whether we're flat out on the ground or whether we're walking on clouds, God can find us wherever we are. So yeah. What else? What was the question?
I think you answered it really well. What was your motivation to seek out support for recovery or to take steps towards recovery?
Why did I recover in the first place?
Yeah.
Okay. It was actually what brought me to the brink of recovery was it was a health issue. My liver enzymes were out of range. And so my doctor wanted me to stop drinking for 3 months and then have them retested. I was very angry about it. I was angry at my body for making me have to make this choice. But I was also angry at myself for having brought me to this place. And I also realized as well that I know I'll die of something, but if I were to die of something drinking related, I ruined my liver, for instance, due to drinking, and that's what was would be my ultimate downfall. I know how mad I would be at myself. I just would be so mad at myself because I know what the right thing is, and the right thing has always been to not drink for me. So that actually is what brought me to recovery this time. This time I say that because I did recover. I stopped drinking for 6 years in my mid-20s to early 30s. And this is going to be my final time because I don't know that I have another recovery left in me. So I just can't risk taking that chance. So that's what brought me to it. But it took me, it wasn't like I didn't leave the doctor's office and say, okay, damn it, she's right. I wrestled with it and fought with it and fought with myself for a couple of months before I decided that it's sort of like I took ownership for the decision to quit drinking. I wasn't going to quit drinking because my doctor told me I had to quit drinking. I needed to quit drinking because I needed to quit drinking. Yeah. And so once I could take that choice and make it my own, then it was like, now I'm just setting a date. And I did, and set it and did it.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. I was just thinking about that. That's just like such a human experience of we know what we should do. Like we should ourselves all the time. Did a whole episode on that. Right? Like, oh, I know that I should take care of myself. I should do these things. And I was thinking about it with relationship to wanting to meditate every day for me with my mental health, when I knew that meditating really helped with my panic disorder and to help me to cope with having panic disorder. And I knew that when I meditated regularly, it was really beneficial, and yet I couldn't bring myself to just do it every day. And I like how you've put it, right? It's like you had to make the decision for yourself, not because everyone else around you or someone else around you or society generally told you what works. And that was, I never really thought of it that way, but that was basically the crux of why I suddenly just started meditating every day. It's also the same reason I started flossing every day.
Yeah.
You just like, you know, yeah, it's always annoying at the dentist. I'm almost like defiantly, I won't floss because screw you, dentist. And then just one day you're like, actually, you know what? I'm getting older. These are all the teeth I have.
Yeah.
Dentistry, you know, it's painful to have this work done. And I know that if I floss, it'll just help me. And
yeah,
I'm just going to do it.
Yeah. But yeah, when you take ownership for the decision of doing it yourself, making your own choice to do it, as opposed to somebody else saying you should do this because it's good for you.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, that's why, you know, nobody will ever quit drinking because somebody else told them that they had to do it. Nobody will ever quit any addiction or any bad habit or anything because somebody else told them to do it. The only time I think that, you know, you'll have true success at doing anything like that is when the decision is coming from inside you.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, basically yeah. Telling other people how to live their lives. It's never worked.
This has worked.
Nope. So. And we've had quite a few different exchanges, and I've seen some of the writing that you do, and it's phenomenal. And you bring great clarity and wisdom to, like, you share these things, these insights that you have in really beautiful ways. And one of the phrases that you've used that I really like is future tripping.
Okay.
I totally love when you talk about future tripping. So could you explain future tripping? I think it seems self-explanatory, but...
Well, future tripping is, you know, when you're just sitting there and you're just like, for instance, I did a little bit of future tripping about our interview today, but, you know, I just stopped that because I just thought, well, I'll just face it when I get to it, which is the whole idea. Future tripping, if you're, you know, worried about what's going to happen in the future, I mean, you take a little trip into the future and it's never good. You don't make up a good future when you're doing that. It's always like the most catastrophic thing that can happen. And it's unrealistic. It doesn't hold water. All it does is create anxiety and stress and disbelief, because I do live in a place of faith in God, that things are happening in my life the way they should be happening. So if I'm sitting around future tripping, well, I'm not really having very much faith in God at that moment, because I'm like already deciding the future and it's bad.
Yeah. So how do you go about refraining from future tripping?
Well, it's just a matter of living in the present, of being realistic. I mean, you just, like, future tripping literally is making something up. You're making up a future that hasn't happened, you know. All we have is this moment, this day. All we have is really this moment right here, right now. You and me sitting here looking at each other on a screen. I don't have anything beyond that. At this moment, I don't have it, you know, whatever has happened up to this point has already happened. It's history, right? And whatever happens in the next 10 minutes or the next 10 years hasn't happened yet. So it's a matter of grounding yourself, I think, in the moment, in the right here, the right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, that's why I meditate, right?
Yeah.
Meditation, formal practice of not future tripping.
Yes, exactly.
And also right? Not past tripping, which again is, it's like the same thing, right? It's where you ruminate on something that's already been and gone and you can't change it.
And so trying to replay it with hoping for what, a different ending in your mind is just, it's just crazy making. It's, yeah. You know, so that's where you have to come around to acceptance of what has happened in the past, in your past,
mm-hmm.
my past.
I like what you said about faith, because from the Buddhist perspective, my teacher Elizabeth Mathis Namgyal, she talks about faith a lot, and when she's talking about faith, she's really clear about saying, like, we're not talking about blind faith. There's a big difference between faith and blind faith. Mm-hmm. Blind faith is just kind of like following blindly without actually questioning anything or thinking about anything critically. Instead of just going along
right.
with what you've been told. While faith itself is a sense of deep knowing and trust in something. And the best example I like to use is in my marriage. It's with my wife. I was like, I cannot guarantee, I can't see that we are going to be together for the rest of our lives. But I have deep faith that we will.
Right.
And I have the faith because I've seen the way that we communicate. I've seen the way that we can work together, that sort of thing. So I love how you talk about having faith in God and having a sense of like using that for the future tripping kind of to bring you back into the present of going like right now in this moment, whatever's happening is exactly what needs to be happening in this moment. And it's what I get to work with.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. I trust God implicitly. I believe God wants us to use our minds and our free will. He doesn't want puppets. We're not in bubbles, little God bubbles being, you know, protected or whatever. So I trust God. I know that bad things are still going to happen in my life. I mean, it's the nature of life. So just because I trust God doesn't mean that I'm completely protected from any bad things happening. And my faith is still a choice that I make because I'm human, so I do have moments of not unbelief so much as just like, is it true? Am I crazy? Is there really God? But there are moments of, I think that's my humanity coming through. In my heart of hearts, I believe wholeheartedly and without reservation that God exists and Jesus Christ died for our sins and the Holy Spirit lives in me and I'm going to heaven at the end of all of this. But it is a choice that I make as well. I choose to be a faith walking woman. I choose to walk in faith. I choose to believe in God. My faith does, it is very sustaining, and it, you know, in those scary moments and in those moments where you're tempted to go into the future, an unknown future, it's like just whoa, Nelly, God's already got it worked out for you, so just keep taking the next right step.
Mm-hmm. So you just said about, you know, that bad things will happen, and and that's the nature of life, which again is something I talk about a lot. Or it's like, it's not like life is out to get you. I was like, life is indifferent, you know. Life just wants to be lived, and
yeah.
And part of life being lived is, and you put it really beautifully, you said that life is, was it awesome and terrible and mundane?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a really good assessment of life. It is
yes.
awesome and terrible and mundane.
And I can't take credit for that concept, that idea. I've been seeing that. I've seen different people writing about that, and it's just given me pause to think that, yes, that is what life is. It's not always a bed of roses, and it's not always a bed of thorns, and sometimes it's just downright boring. So, you know, yeah. It's just, you know, whatever season that we're in is not the season that we stay in. It is constantly moving and changing. And even if we can't see how much it's changing, if you turn around and look back a few days or a few weeks or a few months or, one of the things I read today was look around you in a year from now, everything's going to be different. Mm-hmm. And it's true. If you think back a year from now, I was reading some of the things that I'd written and I had dated them, and some of them were like from a year ago from now. And I'm like, oh my goodness, I can really see the change in myself. I can see that I have grown. And that was something quite exciting for me, because for many years, even when I did write, I never saw any changes in anything. It was always the same refrain over and over. Poor me is what it was. It's, oh, woe is me. How awful is my life? And there was never any epiphanies. There was never any hope. There was never any responsibility for myself taken in any of that. So it's nice to be able to actually look back a year ago and see that I really am changing. I really am growing. So it's not just nice words that I'm saying and I'm like, I hope I'm like that. It's I am like that. I am doing it.
You're actually walking the walk.
I'm walking the walk. Yeah. So it's nice to actually see that. But it's true. Look around you, and a year from now, things will likely be very different. Even a little different, but they will be different.
Yeah. That victim mentality, that's, again, a really human thing to get into, right? Like, life is something happening to me, and it's unfair, and I can't do it. And that, then, you've got this, what I think of from a Buddhist perspective is an awesome mantra of, you can do hard things.
Yes.
It's just a really good reminder that, yeah, life is awesome and terrible and mundane, which, you know, life is rich and multifaceted, and so there will be hard parts of it, and you can do those things, because you're as much a part of life as life is something that you're living.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I did believe for many years that I couldn't do hard things. I believed that if something was too hard, I would just turn around and go the other way, because I couldn't bear the idea of failing, and I was quite sure that I was too delicate. I don't know. I thought I was a special snowflake that just could not handle anything. I couldn't handle anything hard. I couldn't handle anything stressful. I couldn't handle any bad feelings. And poor me, poor me. So why everybody couldn't see that I was such a delicate thing and they weren't all just rushing to protect me was beyond me. But yes, that's one of the things that I have discovered about myself since I quit drinking, is that I can do hard things. I can do really hard things, and there's going to be hard things coming up, and I've gone through hard things, and I will survive them. I will survive them.
Mm-hmm. What was it that shifted in your, like, do you think it was like a gradual thing, or was it sort of an epiphany moment of like, oh, I don't have to be a victim?
Well, it was a little bit of both, I have to say. Even prior to quitting drinking, I was in counseling at one point, and the counselor had said, you know, you do have a bit of a, not a bit of, she said, you have a victim mentality. And I said, uh-huh, sure, yeah, I do. And, you know, and I went away thinking, well, yes, I do have a bit of a victim, so I won't be a victim anymore. But I couldn't process deep down what that really meant, and, mm-hmm. and how that meant that I was living my life. So I didn't know how to change it. So it wasn't until I quit drinking that I could really start. And it wasn't immediate. It wasn't like I quit drinking and realized, oh, poor me, doesn't work anymore. It was kind of a combination of epiphanies and a little bit of a growing awareness. And it was actually reading on Sober Recovery, my sober website, that I started to apply what I was reading when people were talking about, you know, about feeling sorry for yourself and life is not happening to you and at you, and that you can make a change and you can be strong. Then I just slowly started to apply what I was reading to myself and think about how I approach things. And I just always remembered what the counselor had said to me that time about my victim persona. And I was starting to really get that that's why life was too hard for me, because I felt so sorry for myself. I was always feeling sorry for myself, and everybody hated me, poor Juanita, poor me. And it was just, the longer I'd been sober, the more clearly I could see what I was doing and where this was coming from. And so it was like, you know, removing the drunk blinders that, you know, helped me to look more deeply into my life with, you know, no haze of alcoholism or
basically like seeing through the self-deception.
Yes, exactly. Yes. And once I removed alcohol from it, then I could just see more clearly everything that that I was portraying and allowing myself to.
What kind of tools do you use? Like what's your process of self-examination?
What is my process of self-examination?
Yeah. I mean, because I know it's such a hard one, right? Like, my process of self-examination is I meditate every day. That's the whole point, right? Is to sit there with myself and see what's going on and show up for whatever's going on. And I know there's lots of different ways. Like, do you feel like your conversations with God is part of that?
That's it. That's exactly where my mind was going as you were talking there. And I'm like, oh, I guess it would be. Is yes, when I have my conversations with God, I do have a lot of, I'll have, you know, not a lot of epiphanies, but, you know, that's when I'll have little epiphanies about myself and life in general. Also in my writing, sometimes when I have something that's sort of on my mind and I just kind of need to suss it out a little bit and figure it out more, I'll just start writing about it. And I won't necessarily just sit down and write a whole thing. I'll just write a little bit and go away and do something else, and I'll come back and write a little bit more, and I'll go away, and that can be a process that can take like all day just to write a page, one page of something. It helps me just sort of see a little further into myself, and you know, for some reason I seem to be able to put myself out onto a page a lot easier than I can put myself out of my mouth.
You're doing a great job.
I know, I can see that what I just did, but it comes out of the end of my fingers a lot better than it comes out of my mouth.
So let's talk a bit about gratitude, because I think that's all part of this, right?
Is, oh, yeah.
Yeah. How do you define gratitude?
Gratitude, I think, is being aware of what you have in your life, being aware of it and appreciating it. I guess I have, I live in a state of gratitude. I just feel like I have so much to be grateful for. I mean, I just, it is just immense, the amount of blessings and wonderful things that I have in my life that in a way I feel like I don't deserve. I'm grateful to be alive. I'm grateful to have legs and feet and hands, and I'm grateful that I can read. I'm grateful that I can write. I'm grateful for my family. I can't even tell you how grateful I am there. I feel like I've been the grace that has been afforded me by my family has just been a huge, huge gift for me. And I just bask in that every day. It's just, I feel like I spent so many years feeling so sorry for myself that I just couldn't see how much I was loved by my family and supported by them. And so now that I have sort of broken the chains of feeling sorry for myself, and I can actually see it and receive it, and I receive it so gratefully and so humbly. So yeah, I just, you know, I have a fantastic job. I have fantastic employers. I have friends that are just unbelievable friends that are just so wonderful and beautiful. And I love my husband. I love him very much. I love our little home. I love it so much. There's just everything about my life. I love being sober. I love that I am a non-smoker. I mean, it's been 10 years since.
Wow, congratulations.
10 years. And I'm telling you, there's rarely a day goes by that I don't say, thank you, Lord, that I don't smoke anymore, that I am free from that, you know, you see smokers all over the place, and I see them, and just about every time I see somebody smoking, I'm just, thank you that I don't have to do that. I don't judge them for their smoking, because I remember very clearly the strength of that addiction. But I am, it's like there's nothing, it doesn't matter how bad anything gets in my life, every single day there are things that I have to be thankful for. So yeah, gratitude is just, and I'm grateful that I'm grateful.
Exactly. And I think the other part of that is that this gratitude comes from doing the hard things.
Oh, it's true. Yes, it's true. I think, you don't, I don't think you feel maybe the gratefulness for easy things so much, you know, like an easy life just doesn't really, it doesn't inspire a lot of deep emotion and gratitude and humility and all of those things, you know. Mm-hmm. It's nice when it's easy, but not much is going on when it's easy.
No, exactly. I was just thinking again, like, any of my sense of gratitude has always come from seeing what was there in the hardest times of my life. And yeah. Like, we're talking about family. Like, it's amazing. I have such an appreciation for family. And from talking to people who do not have the relationship with their family that I have with mine.
Yeah.
And I talk to people where they hate family holidays. They hate the holidays because it's like, oh, you have to get together and see your family. And they're just like, ooh, and they dread it. And I'm like, I love seeing my family. It's wonderful. I look forward to big family get-togethers. And just because I've, in those times when I was doing the hard things, being able to have that support or see the ways that people show up for me when I haven't always been able to show up for myself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. Yes. And then I'm like, oh, there's some guidance. And I use that, actually. It was interesting. I just got asked recently about how I bring gentleness into my practice, which is another good question. Probably talking about gentleness. And I was saying that to bring a sense of gentleness in when I notice something like, I have a lot of self-aggression and I'm working on it, I think about how it feels to be loved.
Mm-hmm.
And I go to people like you, and I think about my parents, and I think about my wife, and I think about, that's very strong. I want to love myself with the same kind of strength and consistency that I have modeled to me by these other people.
Exactly. Yes.
Outside, so.
Yes, and actually that's, I have to say, that's one of the things that I will always say to somebody who is suffering or feeling bad about something is that to turn the love that they show to other people, it's really important to turn that love inwards. And I don't always do that myself, but I think it's a really, really important thing. For instance, my best friend has been diagnosed with cancer, and it's very hard for her to accept help from people. Very, very hard. She's a very independent person, but she's also a very generous and loving person. And so I want her to treat my best friend, which is her, as well as I am treating her. I don't want her to hurt my best friend, who is her.
Yeah, Gretchen does this to me often, actually, if I'm getting down on myself. She's like, stop talking to my wife that way.
Exactly. That's exactly it. Yes.
It's a really good practice. I really like it. So, yeah, gentleness. And, I mean, again, I think this is a really common thing that a lot of people find really difficult is self-compassion, self-love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What are the things that you use to remind yourself to do that?
Coming back to God again, I do remind myself that God created me exactly to be exactly who and what I am, that He loves me as much, like He is love. What else? Let's see. It is a hard one. It is a hard one to keep a soft focus on yourself, to be easy with yourself. It's one of the other things I struggle with is perfectionism. And that is, that can wield a pretty heavy bat over my head when I feel like I'm not living up to these exacting standards that nobody cares about or nobody else has for me, just what I set out for myself. I'm not even sure where this idea came from. So, yeah, so that's definitely a work in progress to stay soft with myself, gentle with myself, and turn my compassion inwards. But I guess I would say, yeah, believing, knowing, not just believing, knowing how much God loves me. So He wouldn't want me to hate His own creation.
Mm-hmm. I always love that when I speak to other people and I do sort of interfaith dialogues, kind of conversations with friends and also on the show, that like it always comes back to God as love. And I was somebody who was always kind of uncomfortable about God and God, but that now it just makes so much sense. I'm like, yeah, of course, yes, God is this. It's, I find more and more using the word God is a way for so many people to communicate the kind of all-encompassing, unconditional love that we all want.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
It's like, it's there.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Whatever you call it, right? If you call it God, or you call it bodhicitta, is a Buddhist term that's sort of related to it and how I see it. But yeah, that just all-encompassing, sort of tender-hearted, caring, open, loving space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we all deserve it.
Absolutely. Absolutely we do. I mean, every single one of us. I mean, I believe we're all God's children. We're all his creations, and we're all deserving, including myself, of his love. So, yeah.
It's just living it is a little harder.
Living it is a little harder. It's true. I mean, we're human. So I got my feet on the ground. My eyes are on the sky, but my feet are on the ground. I'm here on this world living in it. So I'm just human. So I do remind myself of that I am just human. Mm-hmm. So human and doing the best that I can, and maybe not doing as best as I can some days, but I just try and cut myself some slack. I was coming home from just doing some errands the other day, and I'd had some nice interactions with the people that I'd encountered throughout those errands that I was doing. And it occurred to me that although I'm not absolutely not perfect at it, and I never will be, but my interactions with the people I come across in the world out when I'm doing errands are much more pleasant, and I feel kinder, and I feel more successful at being kind to people in general. And I'm not always perfect at it, but I'm a lot better at it than I used to be, because I was always very impatient and quick to snap and quick to judge. And I'm not like that anymore. So, and I largely credit that for not drinking, just because I am a more thoughtful person now, and I'm a kinder person now, and because I'm not so self-involved.
Mm-hmm. So for the person who is dealing with what feels like a very hard thing of addiction that they can't do, that feels very unworkable.
Yeah.
What advice or resources or supports or guidance would you offer?
Well, it is a tough one, because it really is I've heard it described as, and I think it's a really apt, alcoholism or addiction, let's say, it's a prison where the key is inside. Mm. So there's no one, I can't hand the key to anyone else, and nobody could have handed it to me. I had to find it inside myself. And it's also, it's a jail that you're in that you don't know you're in until you get out of it. And then you can look back and say, like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I was in a prison, in a prison wrapped in chains of addiction. I guess, you know, wanting to be free is paramount. You know, if you don't be free, you will never find help. You'll never escape the addiction. For an actual resource, though, Sober Recovery online has been invaluable to me, especially for me as an introvert who's not really a group type of person. So the idea of going to face-to-face meetings with any type of recovery group, it intrigues me, just simply because I'd like to be with other recovering addicts, but it also scares me because I know that I'm not very comfortable in group settings, especially with a lot of strangers. I have a lot of social anxiety, or whatever you want to call it. So sober recovery has been a really perfect fit for me, and I've actually really engaged in the community, and I post a lot. I've actually just passed 1,000 posts, and I was quite excited when I realized that. I'm like, oh my gosh, I really am involved here. I'm posting, and people respond to me, and it's just been a really, really edifying experience. There is wisdom on there that is just mind-boggling. I just can't even explain it. It's just there to take. It's filled with gold, and it's just teeming with wisdom. And all you have to do is just open up your computer and just start reading. It's just there. The support is just incredible for people that, you know, there's a lot of false starts trying to get sober for some people, and there is a lot of sadness, and sometimes it actually is a little hard to read, and I have to step away a little bit now and then, and other people do too. They talk about it because it is, you know, it's not discouraging, but it's hard to read people's pain that they just have so much trouble sometimes to overcome to get to their first day of sobriety, second day, you know, 1 month. But there's a lot of success stories there too, so it's also very heartening. There's a lot of the wisdom is there because of people's hard knocks and the terrible difficulties that they've gone through, and they are generous in sharing that. So I try and be part of that too, and share my experience with them as well. So yeah, there's a lot of good books out there too. Mm-hmm. I mean, on recovery, there is a ton of great books out there. So that's another thing for people like myself who are less, and you know, there are a lot of people, because even on sober recovery, a lot of people are just, I don't want to go to a AA. I just don't need it, right? Which I understand, you know, I'm like, you know, can't knock them because I'm like right there with you. But there is just so much reading material. It's also filled with wisdom and help and support. And it's good for people to get out and understand that they're not alone, because that's another thing that us addicts do come from, a place of feeling like we're special snowflakes. It's called terminal uniqueness. You know, that we are just like, there's just nobody else has our big problems that we've got. Like, I have just, you know, oh, nobody's seen the trouble I've seen. But really, we are all unique, and we're all individual, and our addictions can be very unique and individual. But there's all a very common, when you break it right down to the bottom, it's all very common, and the stories are really all the same. They all have the same theme running through them, and a lot of that theme is like, poor me. So yeah, we need to get out of our head, and it's until you can break free of the addiction, it's hard to see the poor me. I couldn't see it. So I'm very grateful that I can now. And not saying that I never fall into that, and I do, and then I realize, oh my gosh, I'm doing a poor me thing right now. And I'm like, oh, give my head a shake and look around and see what the real truth is here.
Gently, with love and gratitude.
Exactly. Always gently, with love and with gratitude. I like the gently concept.
Yeah, gentle is very important.
Yes, I do agree.
This has been fantastic. Is there anything else that you wanted to add? Anything that you thought of that you just think would be beneficial for listeners? Or
Self-responsibility, taking responsibility for oneself. I'm my problem. I'm also my solution. That's a quote. I didn't make that up. It took me a long time to understand that, because I heard the quote, thought, oh, that's fantastic. And just like said it to a few people. Oh, isn't that, you know? But it was like about the 100th time that I read it that I'm like, oh, I am my trouble. I see, I am the one. If I can't see myself in a problem, then there is no problem. There is always me, and I'm the only one that I can control. I'm the only one I can change. I'm the only one that I can affect, really. I can be an example to someone else, but I cannot control them. I cannot tell them how to live their lives. In fact, it's been a big learning lesson for me to learn to respect other people's choices and how they choose to live their lives. Everyone has that right to choose how they want to live their lives.
because I live my life this way, because I'm on this path, does not mean that I can drag other people along or force anybody into my way of thinking. It's not my responsibility. It's not my choice. So yeah, just being responsible for myself. So taking responsibility for myself and realizing that that nobody is causing me trouble. Nobody is causing me any trouble at all. I caused all of my own trouble.
And therefore you can fix your own trouble.
Therefore I can fix my own trouble. Exactly. Yes. So I guess that would be my final little thing that I would say.
Excellent. That's wonderful. Thank you for listening. The website my aunt recommends is soberrecovery.com, where you can find support for recovery from any addiction. To find out more about what I do, visit kaylinschatch.com, where you can sign up to get my monthly wrap-up emails, see my artwork, and read my blog. As ever, thank you as well to Dexter Britt for composing the fantastic music accompanying this and the previous two seasons of Everything is Workable.